This is Thursday, August 1st, 2024. We are in Lexington, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan. We are privileged to have with us today Wendy Schoenbach Riesenberg, whose father served as an epidemiologist during World War II. Welcome, Wendy.
Hello. Pleased to be here.
May I ask when you were born?
July 17th, 1941.
And where were you born?
Boston, Massachusetts.
And what community do you currently live in?
Lexington, Massachusetts.
Your marital status?
I'm married.
And do you have children?
I have a daughter.
And tell us a little bit about your father.
My father was someone who was born to be a doctor. In his youth, he lost two sisters, one before he was born and one as a child, to infectious diseases. And infectious diseases was what was happening. And I think he was determined to do something about it, and he devoted his life to fighting infectious diseases.
And your father's full name is Emanuel B. Schoenbach, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I understand he was born in New York City on what would be Veterans Day, 1911. And what was his marital status?
He was married, and I would say that he has a one-digit birthday. It was November 11th, 1911, so it was 111111.
And you are the eldest of three?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And your father, you said your father always wanted to be a doctor. I understand he went to Harvard.
Yes, Harvard and Harvard Medical.
And what, he was in the class of 1937?
Medical school class of 1937, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I understand he was a protege of Dr. Hans Zinsser?
Yes.
And who was Dr. Zinsser?
Dr. Zinsser at the time was the foremost expert in infectious diseases. And in fact, he wrote a book, and he wrote it as sort of a hobby, called Rat Slice in History, which is still a very vital book today, which looks back at the major battles of the time, going back to the Greeks and the Romans, and looks at it from a point of view of infectious diseases and says that they were won by or lost based on the diseases and not by the actions of the generals.
And apparently his quote is, "Wars are lost by generals and won by epidemics."
Absolutely. Yes. And that book was, it turned out to be very popular. It's been printed and reprinted, and it's still available today in libraries, and it's definitely worth reading. Anyway, it's a book that's very worth reading, but his principles are that things like cleanliness and attention to basic things are really as important as guns and things like that. Mm-hmm. And my father was his protege. At some point after my father went through his internship, he went back to Harvard to work with Dr. Zinsser. And they had a very close relationship. Fortunately, Dr. Zinsser died of cancer in September of 1940. And the head of Harvard kept my father on as an instructor. And in January of 1941, there was this incident, as you know, about Halifax. And that's how he was there to participate in it.
So tell us a little bit about Halifax.
Okay, so Halifax, as you know, is a peninsula in Canada. Canada had been at war in World War II since 1939. Because they were an ally of Great Britain, and Germany had invaded Poland in 1939. So they were already at war, and this was bringing a lot of troops back and forth, and they were supplies back and forth between Canada and Great Britain. And as a result of all this movement of populations, new strains of diseases were happening, and there were Halifax, which was an island, it's a peninsula, but it's really very isolated. suddenly found it had three epidemics and they didn't have the wherewithal to deal with it. And they sent an emergency call to Harvard University, to the medical school. And Harvard responded and sent 10 people, including my father, because he had was one of their infectious disease people. Mm-hmm. And they went out and went to Halifax. They spent about a month there, more or less, and solved the problems there.
And for the record, those three epidemics were diphtheria, scarlet fever, and meningitis.
Meningitis, and meningitis was by far the one they feared the most.
So how long was your father at Halifax?
It was about, I think it was about 5 weeks. I mean, the medical school dropped everything, sent these people, they flew in a plane, they landed in a military airport, the first civilian plane to land in a military airport in Canada. They were given emergency medical licenses, and they went to work right away diagnosing the problems, and they just analyzed it, they took samples. I think what's very interesting is one of the things they felt is they had to have data, they had to get ahead of this diseases and know where they were going. And so they were taking throat samples of everyone they could, and they realized they immediately had to immunize against diphtheria, because they did have an antitoxin for diphtheria. And so they decided to start with the schools. And that was easy. They got permissions, and within 2 weeks, they had everyone done in the schools. But they also were staying in the evening for parents and adults to come for free to get these. And people weren't showing up. And it's like, it was okay for my kids, but, and so they had to do an outreach program to try to get the adults in. And while they were vaccinated, they were also taking throat cultures. And if they found anyone was positive, they were isolating them. But it's also key is that they had an experimental drug for meningitis. It hadn't really had a big field test, but they were able to use it, and it was successful. And this meant that at the end of the expedition, my father had state-of-the-art experience in that epidemic. And the reason I mention this is because this is really sort of like what happens next. At the time, now we're looking, it's January 1941, and President Roosevelt, who had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, knew very well the influence of disease and war. He knew, maybe not Zinsser's book particularly, because Zinsser's book was 1935, but he knew about the facts of life of war. And so he formed an Army Epidemiological Board. I think he formed them in the other services. And he said, we're going to keep the troops and the civilian population safe. We're going to do everything we can. And these boards had commissions and subcommissions and so on. And President Conant, who was then the president of Harvard, was on one of the original committees that he had. I think it was my name escapes me now, I think it was the Defense Board. And he recommended to my father, and recommended my father to be on the Army Epidemiological Board as a civilian, which he was, and that was in 1941. Now, my father, the experience in Halifax had a profound effect on my father, and he said to my mother, you know, I don't want to be just a researcher. I really need that patient involvement. I need that contact to inspire me to continue the research. I need to see real people. And so I want to go back and take a residency. And he went back to Mount Sinai in New York. And in New York, he was, I think, the first resident in infectious diseases. And he said, I really want to up my clinical experience. And they were happy to have him because he had all this, now this world-class experience. Well, they moved in like the first day in September 1941, And they were still unpacking when, you know, Pearl Harbor occurred. And they were like, what happened? And they, what do we do? They went to, you know, all the doctors were realizing they probably would be drafted. They didn't know what to do. Nobody knew what to do. When he went to his, the residency at the hospital, the directors were trying to figure out, how are we going to manage? Where are all our interns going to go? Our residents, how do we serve the civilian population? How do we serve the country? What they were trying to organize themselves. And so it was suggested to my father, and maybe to some of the others, that they enlist. And by enlisting, they stood a better chance of having their specialty in the Army. And there were, I mean, there were stories in World War II about pediatricians doing field surgery and so on. So, and he re-enlisted, his appointment at the Army Epidemiological Board was renewed. And he was allowed to finish this one-year internship. And then he went off into the military. And he was stationed in Baltimore, Washington, with the idea that he would bring that knowledge with him to the Army, to the Army Medical Corps.
And I understand he did join the Corps in February 1943 as a captain.
Right. I think that's the usual way that doctors were admitted. Mm-hmm. He was at Camp Carlisle, that I do know. And they immediately, put him to work on various things. There is, anecdotally, I think he did some of the work, did some work on anthrax, which was highly classified. But my mother would tell stories that he would, and this is when I was then a baby, that he would, you know, get in the morning, shower, get dressed, go to the hospital, take off his clothes in one room. You'd shower, get into a hospital scrubs, do his work, leave the clothes in the hospital, take a shower, get into his street clothes, come home and shower. That was the protocol they used, because a neighbor once asked my mother, are you worried about Wendy of him bringing home something? She says, my God, she said, he's the cleanest man in the world. So, but then they were, he was paired up with a fellow, a Dr. Farr, who was, I think, on the faculty at Johns Hopkins Medical. And they told the two of them, you know, meningitis is a very serious problem. We're already seeing statistics, both in factories and troop camps and everywhere, going up higher than they've ever been. We're very concerned about epidemics, and meningitis thrives in crowds. Epidemics in general thrive in crowded conditions. Our troops are going to Europe on boats, and we want them to be able to arrive there in the best possible health. Meningitis has a high kill ratio, and if they hadn't done that, the troops really wouldn't have gotten there in any kind of a fighting form. Mm-hmm. So they immediately set out to attack this disease, which is a worldwide killer, and figure it out. And this is before big research programs and big drug companies. This is all before this, and they were working basically on a shoestring, and they devised this experiment where, and it had to be done all with volunteers. And this was at Walter Reed, and they picked Walter Reed for a variety of reasons. And one is that it wasn't, that, and the Army bases next to Walter Reed, I'm not that familiar with the details of it, but they picked it because the troops at that time, the barracks were not filled overflowing. The men were not doubled up or anything, so they had a decent normal population. The men in there had not been overseas, so they weren't exposed to something from the outside. And they did an experiment of 300 men. The first 100, they were the first they started with 200, and they had to convince the top people to let them do this, and they had to sell it. And their idea was that the 100 men would be the control, which means they're not going to give them anything. The second group of 100 men was going to be given this drug that they'd used in Canada. I'm going to say it wrong, but it's a sulfa drug. And to see how that did it. And what the experiment was they took a cotton ball and they tied it to a string and they put it down their throats, way down their throats, and they had to sit there for 2 hours at a time. The men volunteered for this, and it's detailed in the books. They would sit there for 2 hours at a time, then they would take out the cotton ball and they would put it in a petri dish and see what was growing. And after 10 weeks of this, they had results. And I remember the most fascinating part of this experiment is that the answer was in the control group. The answer was in the control group, because the problem at the time with meningitis is they didn't know how it spread. Why was it so dangerous is that usually in the pre-antibiotic era, if you have an epidemic, you use isolation. You take the sick people and you move them out of the way. But meningitis didn't work that way. So that meant they didn't know how. So here are these two guys, they've been given this assignment. You got to solve this major, major disease. It's been around forever. It's a major killer. It's a major to the war. And they said, we don't even know how it spreads. And they figured that's the first thing they have to know, is what's the mechanics of it. And the solution was in the control group, because what it showed is over the 10-week period, the carriers, that is people who have no symptoms, were in almost all of the, at some point. That is the week one carriers, the week two carriers, the week three carriers. They were all different. But a huge percentage of the of this control group population was carrying meningitis. And so they realized that the secret was that they had to make sure that if a ship or whatever group you were putting together was clean, absolutely clean. And the second group, which I said was having this experiment with the sulfa drugs, was proving effective. And they knew that from the petri dishes. Again, you know, this really hardcore, day after day labor, good old fashioned medical work. You know, you're just doing the lab work and doing the lab work and putting the data together. So it showed that this worked, but it doesn't work for long term. It only worked for a few months. So the secret, which is what he then spent a lot of his career doing, going around and educating the military all around the country, was that if you're going to put a boat, say you have a boat that you're sending, a troop ship, you make sure that every single person on that troop ship, including the crew, has been given the sulfa drug a certain time before you leave. And so that means that everyone on the ship is clean, is not a carrier. And that was the great secret. Of course, they didn't publish because, you know, hello, other side, this is what we're doing. But that's what they did. The third group was, just to get back to the experiment, was that now that they knew that the sulfa drug was effective, the third group was to determine the doses, the right dosage. You didn't want to give too little or it wouldn't be effective. You didn't want to give too much because you have a limited supply of this and you're trying to give it to thousands and thousands of people, so you really want to have it, you know, you want to be as efficient as possible with the, you know, medical supplies are critical supplies, like ammunition. You have to have the right amount. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of his major, major contributions in the war. There were other things that he also did. One was he went overseas. He was sent to Italy. Now, this was after Germany had surrendered. So you'd say, well, why was he then sent Well, he was asked to by the Secretary of the Army, because they were getting reports that U.S. soldiers and prisoners of war in Italy were getting sick, and they didn't know why they were sick. And so he went over there to diagnose it. And so, as my mother tried to remind my father, who was always enthusiastic about any professional challenge, you know, the germs don't know there's a ceasefire. The germs don't know the borders. You're going to countries where they're sanitary systems have been totally obliterated. You know, you're going into a very dangerous situation. But to him, if there was a germ to fight, that's where he went. And they figured out it was a form of diphtheria and were able to treat it that way. They had a situation that I know about where he went to Camp Tyson, where they had an outbreak. I think they knew it was diphtheria, but they were trying to figure out where prisoners of war were getting sick, and also they had brought stuff over, so we now have strains coming from Europe, figure out what to do and to keep not only the troops safe, the prisoners of war safe, and this was key to keeping the population safe, because in those days, well, particularly say like Camp Tyson, the prisoners were used for farm labor. The farmers take a farm family, and the men have been sent off to war, and the women and the older men are trying to keep the farm going. They needed the labor, and so the prisoners of war were happy to do it. It meant it was more like home to them, you know, it was a more agrarian time, and but you have to keep, again, infections. You didn't want infections to spread into the population. So you have to be sure that the prisoners of war were also not carrying diseases. And as I said, again, carriers are people where they don't present any symptoms. Mm-hmm. The most famous one being Typhoid Mary way back when.
Mm-hmm. So including, especially with the work that he was doing in Italy, did he ever say anything about what he saw in Italy? I mean, that was just after the war, and so much of Italy got torn up.
I don't think he toured Italy. I think he went to a particular place. Okay. I think the town was named Caserta, C-A-S-E-R-T-A, and another place. And as soon as he was finished with that, they sent him back. I don't think he went around to a particular.
So by the time he comes back from Italy, let's see, if this was May, it's now like late July, early August?
Yeah, 1945.
Okay. So it's just around the time when folks are kind of worried about going to the Pacific to fight Japan, but the bomb got dropped.
Was right. I think that's when the bomb got dropped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall that. I mean, mm-hmm. The story my mother used to tell was that my younger brother, was about 1 year old and was about getting ready to walk. And she wanted Manny to see his first steps. And she knew he'd be coming home, and so she wasn't encouraging him. And she wasn't discouraging him, but she wasn't encouraging him. And then my father walked through the door, and she picked my brother Vic up, and he literally walked to my father. And that's what I do remember about that. But other than that,
So according to this, he was actually discharged in Baltimore in 1946. So was he continuing his work at Johns Hopkins?
Well, they hired him to the faculty, and he also continued his work with the Army. I mean, his resume has a long list of committees that he was still working with. He continued to work with the Army and as a consultant in Veterans Affairs, just a long list of groups, and also when he went to Johns Hopkins, his work was then shifting to the new field of antibiotics. And he did a lot of work in the early antibiotics. And the books that I wrote really show this, what a kind of trials and tribulations that a research scientist goes in, where you're putting your heart into something and you really hope that it's going to work, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Now, with the antibiotics, way back when, they had money to do clinical trials. And the biggest problem was the side effects. Like, we have found a germ. Antibiotics means a germ kills a germ, basically. Bacteria kills a bacteria. So you find the bacteria that will kill a bacteria for disease, and you're all excited, but it has so many toxins and side effects that it kills the patient. From the patient's point of view, who cares, you know, the gun or the knife? So the solving the toxicity problem, or the other problem was, what's the word? Oh, I know, the bacteria in the quote medicine become the disease bacteria become resistant to the bacteria in the medicine. And in fact, in one of the experiments with the early streptomycin, the disease that it's supposed to be attacking is using the medicine as a nutrient, and they discover to their horror. And how this would happen, I mean, how do they get patients for this, is that, remember, it's pre-antibiotics, so people would come who were desperately ill. They knew they were going to die. They had tried everything they had, and they didn't have anything. And so it's this shot or nothing. So they said, all right, I'll try this medicine. And sometimes it worked and saved a life. And they got better and better at it, and they saved more and more lives. And it was a very exciting era. They were written up in the newspapers. I mean, these research scientists working away in labs in academia normally are not the items of newspapers, but what they were doing was so exciting that what was being reported in the newspapers, reported at medical conferences, were being reported in the newspapers. And he was written up in the New York Times. He was in 1949 at a New York conference for his work on oreomycin. It's an antibiotic that's not used today. He did work on polymyxin, which is used today, but the part where he used it was a disappointment. And this is just an interesting thing about medical research. His group was working on polymyxin to be taken orally, and they were trying to make it. Polymyxin comes from sludge, of all places. It takes a thief to know a thief. Polymyxin, you know, takes to fight, was fabulously successful so far, but it was being given by injection, and it was saving one life after another. But he said, you know, to get into the major leagues, it's got to become a pill where you could get a prescription and go to the drugstore. It can't be that you have to go to a doctor in a hospital and be observed and so on. It has to be, you know, get a prescription. And they were trying it on animals. It was too toxic, and they had to give it up from an oral perspective. But there was another group at Columbia that was doing topical polymyxin, and it was not too toxic for topical, and performed miracles on skin infections. My father was showing that for skin infections and burns and things, it was tremendous. And you can still see polymyxin today. If you go and you buy a triple antibiotic cream, polymyxin will be one of the creams there. But you see the ups and downs of you've saved. We've got this. We're so excited. They were so excited about polymyxin. It was curing so many different diseases. But we can't use it. I mean, they were still using it in an experimental way, but it doesn't become a major drug until it can be put out in a pharmacy to be taken orally. Okay. Another interesting thing that he did, this is after his service, was they were doing experiments on cancer. He had this idea that the way we went after antibiotics and the way we attacked it us that we're going to take the same approach to cancer and we're going to get it. And he had this attitude, you know, this can-do attitude that was so infectious. We can do it. And he had started some experiments with cancer. They were not as successful. I mean, obviously he didn't cure cancer, but I mean, they weren't as successful as they hoped. But one of the most interesting things is they had a clinical trial, and there were two patients that were getting better than everybody else. So why is this? So he studied, went back and studied their records carefully and discovered, well, they didn't have cancer. So they shouldn't have been in the trial. They were misdiagnosed. But they were misdiagnosed for a disease I cannot pronounce. I think it's brucellosis, which was a major killer. And they had found the cure for that. And that was written up in Newsweek magazine in 1951. Sorry, 1952, that he had done that.
If we can take a half step backward, what rank did he have when he ended his military service?
Lieutenant Colonel.
And what kind of awards and commendations did he receive for his service? Because you had mentioned earlier that he gotten all kinds of commendations.
He has a, well, he had all kinds of ribbons that, that I don't understand, but those are for theater served, I think. He got a military citation from S. Bain Jones, Brigadier General, Army Medical Corps, on March 29, 1946. And it's for his work on meningitis and as a civilian consultant to the war, and talks about all his different work that he does. I can read the whole thing, but if you want, but it's a long, do you want me to read it, Maureen?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, all right. It says here, so you can trim out what you don't need. Military citation of Emanuel B. Schoenbach by S. Bain Jones, Brigadier General, Army Medical Corps, 29 March 1946. Recommendation of the award of the Army Commendation Ribbon to Major Emanuel B. Schoenbach, 0-402675 MCAUS. Decoration Awards, Board Office of the Surgeon General. It is recommended that the Army Commendation Ribbon Award be awarded to Major Emanuel B. Schoenbach, Medical Corps, Army of the United States, and member of the Commission on Meningococcal Meningitis, Army Epidemiological Board, for exceptionally meritorious service rendered during the period from 8 February 1943 to 15 March 1945. The following information is submitted in support of this recommendation, which has been prepared in accordance with War Department Circular Number 337, dated 18 December 1945. As a civilian consultant to the Secretary of War, Major Schoenbach was one of the first group to serve the Surgeon General in connection with the work of the Army Epidemiological Board. On 9 March 1941, he was appointed consultant and a member of the Commissions on Epidemiological Survey. He served in this capacity until 1 January 1942. Commission captain in 8 February 1943 and reappointed a consultant to the Secretary of War in March 1943. Captain Schoenbach was placed in the highly responsible position as a member of the Commission on Meningococcal Meningitis. Among many activities, the most important were as follows. From 19 March 1943 to 30 May 1943, Major Schoenbach promoted to Major, 3 June 1944, directed an extensive study of the dissemination of meningococcal infections and of the effect of the administration of sulfadiazine on these infections at Fort George G. Meade, Maryland. This study provided a large amount of additional new information which was useful in the Army program for the prevention of meningococcal meningitis in troops, a program to which the Commission on Meningococcal Meningitis has already made important contributions. From August 1, 1943 to November 1, 1943, and again from 25 August 1945 to 15 November 1945, Major Schoenbeck served as acting director of the Commission on Meningococcal Meningitis. In this position, he carried all the responsibilities for the commission. From 26 September to 20 December 1943, the field study of meningococcal infection was continued under Major Schoenbeck's direction at Fort Meade. He succeeded in obtaining valuable information about the comparative absorption, persistence, excretion, and meningococcal activity of selected sulfonamide drugs. The continuation of the field study of meningococcal infections, with special reference to critical evaluations of techniques and of methods for making surveys, was carried on at Fort Meade again from 14 October to 17 December 1944 under Major Schoenbeck's direction. The Beth methods for making large-scale surveys was formulated in 1944 when problems of diphtheria were increasing in the Army. Major Schoenbeck was requested by the Surgeon General to work with a special group of investigators in collaboration with other consultants and members of the staff of Preventive Medicine Service. Major Schoenbeck made a study of diphtheria immunizations as measured by the Schick test at Camp Ellis and Camp Tyson from 1 February 1944 to 15 April 1944. He participated in an investigation of procedures for immunizing adults against diphtheria. From 25 May 1945 to 24 August 1945, Dr. Schoenbeck, in collaboration with Dr. George D. Gammon, represented the Army Epidemiological Board in an investigation of diphtheria and its neurological complications in the Mediterranean Theater of Operations. Major Schoenbeck was sent overseas at the request of the Commanding General and Chief Surgeon, MTO, in Italy during this period. He carried out an extensive and instructional program and gained a great deal of useful information about the possible relation of diphtheria to polyneuritis of the Guillain-Barré type. This investigation was very useful to the theater and to the Surgeon General. During the whole period from February 1943 to December 1945, Major Schoenbeck supervised the laboratory of the Commission on Meningococcal Meningitis at the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health at Baltimore, Maryland. Numerous problems were investigated at this time. On December 10, 1945, Major Schoenbeck was appointed Assistant Administrator to the Army Epidemiological Board and was brought to the Office of the Surgeon General, where he has been assisting most effectively in the administration of this board. A draft of the citation is attached. Signed, S. Bain Jones, Brigadier General, M.C., Deputy Chief, Preventive Medicine Service Administrator, Army Epidemiological Board.
An incredible career, and of course you're reading that off one of the two books you wrote about your father and his experiences.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, this one, Manny and Francis, An Extraordinary Couple, mm-hmm. is really about his life until his death. He died early of a heart attack in 1952. And then this one, my brothers, I wrote this book originally so my brothers would know about my father. I did a lot of research. It took me about 20 years to write that book. And I tried to write it so it would be understandable by everybody, like a novel. And people have told me they can't put it down. But my brother said, you know, this is a great book, but it has a lot of personal stuff, and we want to give this to medical colleagues that they would want, you know, just the medical part. So the Lifesavers of World War II is just the medical contributions that he did at showing the importance of saving the lives of the troops other than through fighting. And that's why this is a shorter version mm-hmm. and of that book.
Okay. So Wendy, in addition to your father's experiences during the war, you also have some memories of life during and just after World War II, even though you were still kind of a little girl. And one of the items you mentioned was the souvenir your daddy came back from Italy with.
Well, okay. Let's see, just to put it in context, I was born in July 1941, so I was 6 months old when Pearl Harbor occurred. And when he was stationed in Baltimore, there was no housing, and so we weren't there for about 6 months, and then we moved to Baltimore where we didn't know anyone. And the few things I do remember was that there were no, you couldn't buy new appliances, and they had to buy a refrigerator secondhand, which turned out to be a dud, because it was, you know, who knows, the compressor went. And so my mother had to have an ice man come every day and put ice in the fruit bins. It meant she had to shop every day. And it was quite a hardship because with ration coupons, I mean, she couldn't save anything. So I remember that. I remember Baltimore being extremely hot. We were New Yorkers. We weren't used to it. When my father came home from that short visit to Italy, he brought home some souvenirs. And one thing he brought home was he brought home a German helmet. Mm-hmm. He brought home a flare gun where the pin had been removed. And he brought home a Luger, a German pistol. Oh, I guess it's an officer's pistol. Mm-hmm. And my mother did not like any of this at all. But she really drew the line on the Luger. And he said, well, I will put it on top of the mantelpiece. He says, no, this is absolutely not what I want in my house. Get rid of it. Her father had died in a gun accident. And there's no way she was going to have a pistol in the house of any kind. And he made him, probably sold it to somebody else. So that left the house. The helmet stayed in the house. It was too heavy. We put it on. It gave us a headache. Probably shouldn't have, but it was very heavy. And the flare gun, we could hardly pick it up. But when we were older, we played with a little. I think about it now. We should have just gotten rid of it all. I remember personally looking at the signature. They had a leather interior. And there was a signature in it, which I guess must have been the guy's name. And I remember thinking as a little girl, who is this person? What has happened? I remember the blackout curtains. We'd have to put the blackout curtains on. And there were no toys. There were no toy stores. We played with the things you had around the house, clothespin dolls and pots and pans and, the really basic things. So anything you had, when I got my first bicycle, it was secondhand, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier that your father passed away rather suddenly in 1952.
Yes.
And a couple of years later, you were awarded an AMVET scholarship. Tell us about that.
Okay. It was more than a couple of years. What happened was... And when I think about it now, looking back, it's a little bit ironic that a top doctor working in a top hospital, surrounded by doctors all the time, dies of a heart attack in the middle of the night on Labor Day weekend. He was attended by the head of cardiology at Maimonides Hospital, who happened to live nearby, and they called and he came over. But it shows in 1952 what they didn't know. They really knew nothing. I mean, they were no EMTs. They didn't know about aspirin. They knew very little. Anyway, he died in the middle of the night. I was 11 years old. when I was a senior in high school, a friend of my mother's, who was active in school affairs, discovered that I would qualify to apply for an AMVETS, American Veterans Scholarship. And so I did. It turned out that it was the same exam that was given to the merit finalists, which I didn't know until after the exam. And so I felt, well, this was a waste of time. All I know is I had the biggest headache I've ever had in my life after that exam. And I went home, and what's kind of ironic is that I didn't qualify to take the merit exam going the usual route. And the other people in the class, when I was sitting for the exam, looked at me and go, what are you doing here? Well, I said, I'm here to take a test. So I sat there, and the instructor gives out these envelopes to everybody and says the standard things you do. And then he says, okay, go ahead. And then he pulls out another envelope that looks identical to theirs, but who's paying attention? Or he opens an envelope, pulls out an envelope that then looks like theirs, it's just a manila envelope, and puts it on me and says, there you go. So I open it up and I start reading the instructions, and it sounds awfully familiar, like I've just heard it. And I had just heard it. And so anyway, I take the exam, come out with a headache, and after the exam, the other people in the room, who I knew from my college English class, are talking to each other about the test. What do you think about this question? What do you think about that question? Oh, I had that, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, the questions are sounding awfully familiar. I heard what they're saying. I said, it sounds like my test. So I go home thinking, oh my God, I took the merit finals. Well, forget this. Well, a few months later, I'm at home alone. I just come home from school. I'm literally half dressed. I'm getting out of my school clothes and the phone rings, and there was only one phone in my mother's bedroom in the front of the house. And I go to the front and I'm on the floor because I don't want to be seen through the windows because I'm not quite dressed. So I'm sitting down below the bed and I answer the phone and he says, hello, my name is Bill English and I'm from Ambetz. And I'm like, oh my God. And he said, well, would it be possible for me to come over tonight and talk to your mother? You've won a scholarship. And I said, yeah, I'm sure it would be. And I'm like in shock. And he came over, a very nice young man, talked to my mother and said, we're going to have there's going to be a ceremony for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers for Korea and World War II. And we want some of our winners to come down and be there and be our guests. We'll take care of everything. So mother said, yeah, fine. You know, and I was like, great, this is good. What's interesting is my high school was, my homeroom people were all excited, but the other people were not really, like, be sure your work is done and so on, you know. Big New York high school, just another person. Anyway, I'll leave that out. It was my first trip on an airplane. We left in a thunderstorm from LaGuardia Airport, but I was just so excited. And we got there, and it was like being in a whole new world. I mean, as you can imagine, most people who grow up with a single parent have to have a reasonably frugal lifestyle. I never, you know, wanted for anything particularly, but I mean, you know, everything's careful. And suddenly, we're taken in limos and taxi cabs everywhere. We're staying at a hotel that's on Embassy Row. And of course, I'd never been to Washington before. I mean, and we're being treated, you know, like royalty. And we saw some of the sights and so on. Some of the highlights of it, they, you know, we just didn't believe. We were well-behaved kids, basically. We were from different parts of the country. There were eight of us that came on the trip. I think there were 17 winners overall, but there were eight of us. And I had tied for first place. There was one other person from New York. We lived in Brooklyn at the time. So there was one other person from New York State. My roommate was from Texas. And we went to they took us to the Pentagon, and we met the Assistant Secretary of the Army, who, I think they gave us a model plane or something. I just don't remember. We were just so overwhelmed that we just went through and sort of went, yeah, thank you. And we got to eat in one of the Pentagon cafeterias with this great big tray, and they're serving us like we're men, you know. They have this a ladle that I now use for a whole family. They're just, you know, this and that. Anyway, but that day we were driven to the White House, and we were going to meet the president. And I don't think I had registered to me until we actually got to the White House. And when you're in the White House, they escort you around very efficiently. You don't even feel, you just But we were zipping by the tourist line and up, and you're now in your own special room. My roommate was from Texas, and the Ambetz chapter in Dallas, Texas, had given her a 10-gallon hat to bring to President Eisenhower. And she had it in a black case that looks like the old manual typewriter cases. And in those days, we had the big skirts, so with the big crinolines and everything. And they put her last in line, and she had the typewriter on her left, and so it was sort of against the wall, and she was just sort of being discreet and bringing it along. Now, when we got to the room where we were going to meet President Eisenhower, there was a bench on the right side that went along the room, and behind that bench were 20, maybe 30 photographers, all standing around, you know, routine photo op, high school kid gets president, send to local papers, and so they're sort of chatting, and, you know, just a regular day in the day of a journalist. For us, this was like, I just can't describe it. We were just completely, like, in shock. And so we're in line, and there's a little desk at the end of the room, and President Eisenhower comes from a door behind that desk, and he starts presenting the awards. We went up one at a time, we shook his hand, and he gave us the Ambetz Awards that the Ambetz people had previously, and congratulations, and so on. Now, my friend Jeanette, who was my roommate, was behind me, and she was shorter than I was. And she gets up there, and she reaches down, and she flips open the case, and she pulls out the hat. And she says, "Mr. President, on behalf of all the Ambetz in Dallas, Texas, I want to present you with this 10-gallon hat." And Eisenhower beamed, and the press suddenly realized that this is the picture that they want. And they're so excited, and they're pushing forward, that they push forward on each other. The bench tips over, and flash bulbs popping, they land on the floor. All of them, one, two, while we sit and watch, in total and complete shock. We don't say a word. I just sat there. I think my mouth wasn't like, we were like frozen in place. And they land, ba-da-ba-da-da-da-dum. Then, as soon as it happens, right afterwards, not a word is said. They all pick themselves up. And it's almost like the film rewound. They, yep, two Secret Service or aides put the bench right up, and 2 seconds later, it looks exactly the way it was. It's like it never happened. And afterwards, he presents Jeanette with the award. And afterwards, he sat and talked with us. He stood and talked with us for a little bit. He was very gracious, very kind. And he had been a general, and in a sense, these were his kids. And It was just a moment. He was very gracious, and it was just a really wonderful moment. And that was probably the highlight of the trip, was that. And then we went to the tomb of the ceremony. In those days, Memorial Day was celebrated on the day, so it was a Thursday, I believe. And we went to the ceremony, and the weather was good, and I remember the seriousness of it. I had never been to a formal military ceremony. I'm not from a military family, and it was just so impressive, and the respect, and the whole, just left a tremendous impression on me of that ceremony. And the whole week, I'll just never forget of how wonderfully we would really treated, and the scholarship was significant. I won $2,000, which was $500 a year, which in those days turned out to be 25% of going to a small private college, room and board, and everything was about 25% of the cost. So it was very, very helpful to myself. And I'm very grateful to Ambetz for that.
So, Wendy, you did go to college. What was your major?
Oh, we're really going in a different direction here. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I started out to be a bio major, but I couldn't handle the smells of organic chemistry. They were making me dizzy, and I found what I liked was working in art, which I had taken as a, what do you call it, you know, that one course you take for fun. And so the New York State College of Ceramics at Alfred University, I went to Alfred University, the New York State College of Ceramics was there, and I transferred New York State College of Ceramics, and I became a designer. And afterwards, I went to, I thought I would need a school that was more worldly, word of it. And I went to the Pratt Institute, and I got a Master's of Industrial Design. And I worked there for in industrial design for a while. But then, after I had my daughter and I was looking to go back, I found that industrial design wasn't what I had thought it was. That is, I had studied that you're given a problem, you try to come up with a creative solution within the parameters of the industrial process and the what the client needs and what you're trying to do, the price range and so on, you try to solve it. But what they were doing was they were taking products that were manufactured elsewhere and manufacturing them here. So in other words, wasn't it creative? It was just taking somebody's design and moving here. And I felt I needed something that was more creative. And what I remembered was that somehow all the decisions that were made in my work were made about the people that spoke money. And I realized that I have to learn how to speak money because I wanted the creativity, the ideas, not, it wasn't so much the coloring the pictures or doing the medium technique. So I went back to school and I went to the University of Lowell and Bentley College and I got a degree in accounting. And then as I went to work, as I was interested in taxes, I ended up getting a master's in taxation from Bentley College. And I worked in, I got my CPA, and I worked there for a number of years. But I've been involved in a whole bunch of different things. I've always sculpted, and it's always been a hobby. I mean, not recently, it takes a lot of physical work, which I don't do now. So I've been involved in that. I've been a town meeting member, just various things. But I found accounting, people would say, well, in fact, my mother would say, accountant, how? Mm-hmm. How does this happen? My artist becomes an accountant. And actually, to me, they were both professions that deal with problem solving and creativity and dealing with a person's situation and trying to help that situation. Now my younger brother Vic, who's 3 years younger than I am, who also won an AMVET scholarship, I would say, mm-hmm. and he went to Washington and he met President Kennedy. He became an epidemiologist and has had a distinguished career at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in their School of Public Health, and he has won awards for his efforts in epidemiology. He has worked with things like AIDS, smoking cessation, and other areas. And he has been very active in minority women's health. They have a conference there every year on minority women's health, and they now dedicate a lecture to him, and in his honor, he's still with us, mm-hmm. very active, and so in a sense, he's followed in my father's footsteps. But I don't think he knew it at the time, shall we say? Mm-hmm. My other brother Vic, other brother Andrew, was younger, 7 years younger. Had a very distinguished career in government. He was a branch chief at the Office of Management and Budget, serving from Presidents Reagan up through Obama. And these are non-political positions. And this is something that people don't understand in the newspaper, that how important our civil servants are. They are apolitical. They are trying to get the job done for the country. They're trying to deliver a service. And his office, his particular branch, was the branch that assembled the federal budget. So they worked under a lot of pressure. They worked many long hours. And for them, it's all about service. And OMB works for the president. One of his major contributions was a program, I think it's called MAX, but what it was a wiki, which was how different federal agencies could talk to each other without meeting and assemble information and have information available and have different layers about it. You know, the public could have this much and certain people could have this much, and so that it is very important in providing access to all kinds of services, especially medical services. The Navy and some of the other services were major, I think still are, he's retired now, major clients of these services that he developed. I think it was developed through Office of Management Budget, but I think it has now been transferred to agriculture. I don't know why or how or what, that's beyond me, but these are major contributions in helping government function in terms of serving the needs of people. And his wife served as in the I gotta think of it now, SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health. She was an acting director and assistant director. Also in terms of getting services out to people. You know, Congress votes money for a program, but the rubber hits the road when it gets down to the implementation. And that's what the two of them have been active in. Very proud of their work.
Wendy, you do come from a most remarkable family.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap things up?
Well, I would say that I would like to say thank you to all the veterans out there and to all the people who have participated in clinical trials, and to recognize their contribution and their bravery in keeping our country safe. And thank you for the privilege of speaking today.
Okay. And thank you so much, Wendy, for taking part in the Natick Veterans Oral History Project.
Thank you.